If you have your Bible, turn with me to Ruth, chapter 2, and we'll be looking at verses 17 to the end. Ruth, chapter 2, verses 17 till the end of the chapter. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. Her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living and the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all of my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." And she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. As this story begins, it's Ruth coming home from her first day of work there in Judea as a gleaner. If this was a Jeopardy category, it might be famous first days. Famous first days for 50. You know, who gleaned a remarkable amount of barley on her first? What would be Ruth? See, that would be the Jeopardy answer. What would be Ruth? You hear about, you know, first, there's a number of major leaguers. If John Walker was here tonight, he'd be able to instantly tell us of the various baseball players who hit a home run the first time they ever entered a major league game. There's a number of them. Their very first at bat. Home run. It's like, wow, it's just absolutely extraordinary. You know, made me think of my extraordinary first day of school, Fort St. James, British Columbia. You say, well, big deal. Well, it was to me. It was to me way more than I realized. We left Illinois and we drove up there, 2,000 mile drive. A 2,000-mile drive to what seemed to me certain doom. Why do we have to move up there? We'd been to Canada one other time. They didn't seem to like Americans very well. Now we're going to this place in Fort St. James, which you've never seen in your life. And we drove up there, unloaded our little trailer, and then by then it was late in the day and no reason to put it off. So the next day you're going to go to that school for the first time. I knew I was dreading it, but I didn't know how much I was dreading it until in the middle of the night, I woke up and found that I was literally drenched with sweat. Could almost have wrung it out of my shirt, which kind of disturbed me even further. Oh, wow, I'm going there and I'm losing my mind at the same time. You know, that sort of dread and pressure was just incredible. So my dad checked in at the office, and then the assistant principal walked me down to my classroom. But on the way, a kid a year younger than me, he knew I was coming, and he caught up and said, "Hey, you know, let me go. I want to, you know, I knew this kid was coming to town. Let me introduce him to my friend Barry." So he did. Still remember, there was my first class there was a biology lab, and there at the lab table right in there was Barry Hiroteri, a young Japanese kid who had lived in Fort St. James all his life. He was born and raised there, and he instantly treated me quite kindly, and in fact, at the end of school, he invited me to come over to his dad's garage. He watched a filling station after work, and so I went with him right after school down to that filling station where we listened to Creedence Clearwater Revival between pumping gas, and then I began to learn the art of road hockey for the first time in my life. It was March. They had record snowfall in British Columbia this year. I'd never seen such piles of snow. And Barry's dad's garage was right on the edge of Fort St. James, but literally across a little gravel road from Stewart Lake, and Stewart Lake stretches to the north. You can watch it for about 35 miles, and then it takes a bend for about the last 20 miles and a little bit narrower, and it's all surrounded by mountains. And in March, they're all covered with snow. The lake was completely frozen over, so you just looked up this icy wasteland for 35 miles to these mountains surrounding what would be what is Lake Stewart Lake. And by the time I went back to school the next day, there's just no anxiety at all. This kid was amazing, like he had been dropped down from heaven. We're still friends. He's down in Palm Desert, California right now on vacation to escape the Vancouver rains of this time of the year. What an amazing first day. No, I didn't think at the time. What was a remarkable providence that day, that I would meet somebody on the very first day that I would remain friends with for 44 years. Right up till now. That's an amazing first day. He would later come to faith in Christ himself, which he certainly didn't have on that first day. Well, that's what's going on here. In fact, this story revolves around what a shockingly great first day Ruth had as a gleaner. It opens with just a real simple statement that she came to the end of the day. Verse 17, I'd put this more or less banner over the top of it. an amazing first day at gleaning. And I don't know exactly how Ruth experienced it, where she was theologically. But as we read this 17th verse, it's clear in the context. See, this is not the story of Ruth's amazing piece of luck. It's not the story of Ruth's amazing ability as a gleaner. It's not even a story about the incredible kindness of the men and women of Bethlehem, you know, sort of a Chamber of Commerce ad for them. Oh, come to Bethlehem. You know, look at how they treat even foreign women like Ruth. Well, the men of Bethlehem probably wouldn't have treated her anywhere nearly that well. And ultimately, it's not even a story about a tribute to Boaz's kindness and godliness, though that's very much involved in what happens. But that's not ultimately what it's about. Rather, in fact, we're reading a story about God and the hand of God on a young woman's life on a stressful first day in which, as a foreign woman, probably with limited skills in the language, she launched off to find a place to try and get enough food together to keep herself and her mother-in-law from starving. That's how the day begins. But it ends in an unimaginably more positive light. So, number one, an amazing first day at gleaning. Verse 17. Chapter 2, verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah of barley. Now this is, if you remember how we started out, why have a commentary in the book of Ruth? It's such of a simple story. But you remember that the Schlotke in his little commentator in the Hebrew Bible series, not a Christian commentary, but written purely from a Hebrew Bible perspective. His comment to us was, judging from the English translation alone, or even from the text of the Hebrew, the reader may be tempted to wonder what room there is for comment or elucidation. The simplicity of the style of the book of Ruth and the directness of the plot seem to leave little to the imagination. That is so if we read but do not ponder. The Bible should not be so treated. Its words should be weighed and measured. I don't know how many times some of you have read through the book of Ruth, but I wonder whether you have ever even paused, and often with a just simple note, you'd go to the bottom of the page and you'd get to what's going on here. But when it says that Ruth came up with an ephah of barley by the end of the day, the scholars argue a little bit about just how much that is, but the range of their argument is still all an extraordinary amount. In other words, she came home lugging a bag of 30 to 50 pounds of barley, which would be absolutely impossible to glean under normal circumstances. Nobody could possibly have done that. Naomi, and that's the scene. See, here comes Ruth, and she has beaten it out at the end of the day, and she's filled up her bag, and she has an entire ephah of barley. And it's unbelievable, as we'll see. Simply unbelievable. Dr. Block suggests that when over in 1 Samuel 17:17, you remember that David is sent to the front lines. Goliath has been coming out into the valley of Elah every day and making the great challenge. And David sends a set of food out there, or actually Jesse does, through David, for his brothers. Well, in the context, it's not just for his brothers. It's for his brother's troop, if you will. Probably a group of about, they'd figure, 50 men. And so he's got the 10 heads of cheese that he sends out, and he sends 10 loaves of bread, and he sends an ephah of barley. Enough barley for 50 men. And Ruth comes home at the end of her first day of reaping, and she's lugging along with her an ephah of barley. She beat it out, probably at the threshing floor, because you remember, as a gleaner, she would have no access to that. But he's given her the full rights of a full-time employee. She eats like the full-time employee. She drinks from the water jugs of the full-time employee. She almost certainly gets the use of the threshing floor at the end of the day as if she was a full-time employee. And so she goes there. She beats out all of this grain that she has picked up throughout the day. But clearly, as the commentators note, Boaz's people did just what he told them to do. They threw a lot of grain on the ground in front of her throughout the day, which is what he said. He said, you let her have access to the already gathered stalks, and you dump some grain on the ground in front of her. Well, they listened to him, and they did it. And she kept on picking it up and picking it up and picking it up. And she gets to the end of the day, and she has 30 to 50 pounds of barley. Secondly, verses 18 and 19. An amazed onlooker, that would be Naomi. Verses 18 and 19, listen to what happens. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. So, you know, when she finished lunch, you know, she got the doggy bag, you know, pack up the rest and I'll take it home to my mother-in-law. And so she's got all of that, plus the 30 to 50 pounds of barley. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? I mean, that's how you're supposed to hear that is, where in the world did you glean today? Or, as my father would have put it, for crying out loud, where did you glean today? That's impossible. What you're lugging there, how in the world did you do that? That's what she's saying. Because it's impossible. No gleaner ever comes up with what Ruth has at the end of the day. It doesn't matter how hard you work. And we know why. we know why. She wasn't just the gleaner. I mean, she had so much inside help that it's almost inconceivable. And don't miss this. Naomi spent most of the day wondering, for very good reason, whether Ruth would be sexually molested before she got home. And whether she'd be able to bring anything home, because it was a dangerous place for single young women out there that she walked out into that day. And it was an especially dangerous place for single young foreign women that she walked out to that day. So you can imagine that if Naomi had any compassion at all, she spent the day worrying, wondering, what is going on? What is happening to Ruth? How is she doing out there? And you come to this at the end of the day, and she looks out, and here she comes with her leftovers in one hand, dragging a bag of 30 to 50 pounds of barley with her. And Naomi, where in the world? Where in the world did you get that? 1965, Halloween. Oh, that was a good year for me. I was out there wandering the neighborhood with my friends. About 8 years old, my brother, he's 4 years older than me, he's 12. We had parameters set for us in Rockford, but Rockford was a pretty safe place for kids still in 1965. We didn't worry too much about our neighborhood. We ran all over the place and had a deadline of when you were supposed to go home, so you had to have your watch for sure. But right near the end, this just incredible thing happened. I was up walking along Broadway, and we pulled over into this house, and it was an older gentleman who had clearly decided that one of his grandchildren was going to win a sales contest for candy bars at school. You know, the kind of big candy bars that at that time you sold, they probably were 50 cents then, when regular candy bars were a dime and a nickel. But that's what he had. He had a box of them seated by the door, and then it was just him, and he would open the door, he'd reach down in the box, you stuck your bag in, and he threw one of those in there. Oh, wow. Wow. So now we finish our trick-or-treating, you know, and we get home, and my mom and dad, my sister didn't trick-or-treat by then, she's 16 years old, so my brother and I come in, you know, and we've got our, you know, and overall, he's got more candy than I do, so in that sense, I've lost. But I do have my secret weapon, right? So I ask him, what's the best thing you got? Oh, he pulls out several, you know, full-time candy bars. That's about as good as you did. Somebody that would actually buy you a real Hershey bar and hand those out. That was pretty. You were being pretty generous if you did that. Most people, you know, are just buying you, you know, you get one Hershey's Kiss or something like that. So he showed me his. And then I reached in. And what do you think his question was? It was Naomi's question. Where did you glean today? Where did you get that? Oh, up on Broadway. Oh, I'm going to run up there. And my no, it's too late. Too late for you. Yeah, that's when you get punched. Too late for you. But that's this. Where in the world? That's what's new. Where in the world did you get that much grain at the end of the day? Unheard of. And now in tribute to Naomi, look what she does. You know, she hasn't seemed to be the godliest gal in the bunch to this point, but she's open to this, clearly open to this, because she runs right into it now. Naomi sees instantly in this, not just Ruth's good luck, she sees instantly in this evidence of divine intervention. She thinks Godward. Her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? Where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. That is, may God bless whoever it is. Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Ruth then starts telling the story of Boaz. Now, in this moment, you know, you could write a song about it. We have songs about Jesus that would fit here. You know, you would say, "Tell me the story of Boaz. Write on my heart every word." Well, he's actually a type of Christ. That wouldn't be a bad analogy at all. Tell me the story of Boaz. Now, Naomi, of course, knows who Boaz is. That's not the issue for her. But Ruth tells the story of Boaz, and it's vastly beyond anything that Naomi would have expected. Remember, Naomi no doubt has reasons why she didn't go to Boaz in the first place. She didn't say anything to him. She had no confidence whatsoever that Boaz would be kind, interested in helping, thought that he might be full of disdain, give her a couple of lectures again, as we've said, about running off to Moab like she did. But now Ruth starts to tell her about what happened and what Boaz has said, and it's absolutely incredible. Of course. And Naomi didn't think this was within the realm of possibility. "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law where she had worked and said, "The man's name is Boaz. I worked there today." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Now there in verse 20, there is a linguistic ambiguity. You'll notice how it reads in the ESV, and the ESV has leaned its interpretation in a clear direction, and we'll test how you would hear the ESV. So Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord, whose kindness," that is, whose loving kindness, "has not forsaken the living or the dead." Oh. So whose loving kindness is he talking about there? Boaz's or God's? May he be blessed of the Lord, whose loving kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Well, it seems to be maybe God's loving kindness. In the Hebrew, it's perfectly ambiguous. You can't possibly tell. Now, there's some commentators, more or less of the unbelieving variety, who say, well, you know, yeah, the author of Ruth, for the most part, is a decent storyteller, but a little sloppiness showing up here, so you can't tell. Our speaker from last spring, Dr. Block, yeah, he says to that, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. This is the author of Ruth telling stories at the most precise level. That is, this sentence is carefully structured to be intentionally ambiguous so that you will be stuck overlapping two things that in the story necessarily overlap anyways, but now we're going to make it linguistically necessary as you wrestle with this, that you start to see it doesn't matter which way you go, it comes to two ways of saying the same thing. By that, the author is saying this. Naomi is reflecting on the fact that she's shocked simultaneously by the loving kindness of Boaz and by the loving kindness of God through leading Ruth to Boaz, and then Boaz's shocking response to Ruth. And she doesn't know exactly how shocking the response even is yet as she says this. But also, keep in mind, this word for kindness, loving kindness, this is the single most important theological word in the Old Testament. This is like grace in the New Testament. This is where hesed shows up, where loving kindness shows up. That's as good as it gets with God, right? That's the word at the end of each of those lines in Psalm 136. His loving kindness endures forever. His steadfast love endures forever. Hesed endures forever. Hesed endures forever. Hesed. How in the world did we end up with this hesed? Who's hesed? Well, you can say it either way. Boaz is hesed through Yahweh, because Boaz's loving kindness is due to his godliness. Or Yahweh's hesed through Boaz. Oh, it's God's loving kindness, but as he often does, he exercises that through people who he has previously made godly and useful to his ends in this precise loving kindness, steadfast love sort of way. And that's what's going on there in verse 20, this intentional ambiguity. May you be blessed of the Lord, whose loving kindness, the Lord's loving, Yahweh's loving kindness, Boaz's loving kindness, has not forsaken the living or the dead. Who's living? Naomi and Ruth. Who's dead? They're two husbands. And here's Boaz taking care of the widows, taking care of the living in behalf of the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man's a close relative of ours. And then Ruth said, the Moabite. Well, besides that, you know what he said? You shall keep close to my young men until they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter-in-law, that you go out with the young women. Notice the little switch there. Yeah, well, don't stick so close to the young men. But it'd be a good idea to stick close to the young women. Lest another in the field, if you go to another field, they'll assault you. There's the signs of the times again. So she crept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. You know, their times, that's a remarkable picture of their times, the days of the judges, dark days. Looking at this in this past week, it's remarkable to notice our social commentary, wherever you think of the politics of the last week. It's incredible what was never said by most of these stories that came forward. Without question, there's very few places more dangerous for a young woman to go than to a party where there's a lot of men drinking too much. 16, 17-year-old men, 23, 24-year-old men, wouldn't make much difference. It's a very, very, very dangerous place to be. You notice how often that danger was mentioned this last week? Never. Never. Not one senator. Not one television commentator. No one. All these stories. The environment has that effect all the time. That's why that the stories are automatically plausible. That kind of thing. Constant. Universities famous for it. All of them. Not one condemnation of it. Not one warning about it. Not one. Not one commentary on what kind of society do you have is when you go off to higher education, this is the normal environment going on a regular basis virtually everywhere. Not one. Well, there's a good reason. There's no spiritual king in the United States, and everyone is off doing what's right in their own eyes. We live in the same kind of deadly, dark place. And Naomi knows where she lives. Oh, no, Ruth, you stay close. But do you hear what Naomi's just been told? Now, this guy says that we can expect this sort of glean day after day after day until the harvest is over. Well, their economic problem is now over. If she's bringing home that every day, There it is. It's all taken care of. It's absolutely astonishing. And so she says, "It's good, my daughter, that you go with these young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Now, when we read a story like that, the really, really important thing is that we see the hand of God in it. Boaz is who he is because of a preceding godliness. Boaz's loving kindness and God's loving kindness come to roughly the same thing. God exercises his loving kindness through your loving kindness and mine and other people's lives most of the time. That's how he does it. It doesn't just come flying out of the blue. It comes flying through you. As you do things for godly purposes. That's all Boaz is really doing at this point. It's unlikely that he would have made the move that he makes without Naomi's help. But that's, as Paul Harvey would say, that's the rest of the story. Naomi's going to take a huge gamble at this point, as we'll see as we go into chapter 3. And she's going to hope and she's going to bet with Ruth's life that Boaz might be interested at even a deeper level. And it's risky what she does next. It's really risky. But she thinks that the loving kindness of God has shown up, and that it just might be that all of both of their problems have been brought by the living God right to their door in this wealthy, middle-aged, godly man who has shown a shocking interest in Ruth, largely because he has had, to Naomi's wonder, such of a shockingly positive assessment of what Ruth did for Naomi in coming home with her. Because that's what he says it's all about. I heard what you did for your mother-in-law. And here you are out gleaning for her today. Well, I think I know what to do now. And he takes care of the two of them without any formal charity at all. You know, just throw grain in front of her wherever she goes. That's pretty much, you know, let her take grain from the most obvious places, and beyond that, just toss some in front of her as she walks across, she walks up behind you. Just drop it right in the ground. She'll be diligent. She'll pick it up, and she did. And we're to understand, very likely, and that just went on day after day after day after day after day. If you look at your own story, you'll see, if you're a believer in the Lord, this is not an altogether foreign story to your own experience. On either side of it, Naomi and Ruth have seen some dark days. Days of death and uncertainty and travel and fearfulness and risk. But also days of incredible blessing and provision and the hand of God and the clear, clear sense that the loving kindness of God has landed. And as believers in Jesus Christ, that's surely where we are. The loving kindness of God has landed. I should never forget the rest of my days. My first day of school in Fort St. James, when I was sat down next to Barry, here with Terry. Changed everything about that place. That first day was all set. It was all set. I never had a friend closer to me than him the whole time I lived there, from right there. Right there. Well, that is not likely to happen. No, it surely isn't. That was the gracious hand of God. Answering more my parents' prayers than mine, because I wasn't praying about it all that much. I was mostly just ticked off that we were moving there, and my life was being ruined. But God, all the way, where we started, all the way, my Savior leads me. And he does.